Moncrief on News Talk.
Now, in the meantime, here's a philosophical question. If there is a soul, where does it reside in the body? In the 1960s, one neuroscientist became so obsessed with this question that he made it the subject of his research by trying to transplant brains. Dr. Brandy Shillace is the author of Mr. Humble and Dr. Butcher, A Monkey's Head, The Pope's Neuroscientist, and The Quest to Transplant the Soul. And Brandy joins us now on News Talk. Brandy, good afternoon to you.
Hello, very nice to be here. I just want to say it's actually Schillace, though it's safer if you pronounce it Shillace, because it's the same last name as a certain soccer player that might not be all that popular in Ireland.
Okay, Schillace. All right, thank you very much for that correction. Now, Dr. Robert White, tell us something about, I mean, as you sort of lay it out in the book, it's almost like he's two different people. So tell us something more about the human side of him and the family man, the devout Catholic.
Absolutely. So, you know, he was a very, very devout man, very faithful, very, very much a Catholic believer. And in fact, he ends up being friends with two popes. I mean, I don't even know how you become friends with one pope, but he was friends with Pope Paul VI and then later Pope John Paul II. He had 10 children and he was a brain surgeon. He was somebody who spent all of his time trying to save lives, operating on brains, and who, you know, was well beloved in his community for that service. But he was also a brain scientist, a neuroscientist, and it was his work on that side of things that tended to raise eyebrows.
Yeah, and also just in terms of that Catholic connection, he was an advisor on medical ethics to John Paul II. Is that right?
He was. He helped to establish the Vatican Council of Bioethics. And again, some of the things about Dr. White seem like they shouldn't exist in the same person, because, you know, to care a lot about ethics and then take the heads off things doesn't always seem like it should go together.
Yes, indeed. But there does seem to be a great intersection between his religious faith and his work. He would always pray before he operated and that kind of thing.
That's absolutely true. And he actually also went to a mass every evening after work. So, I mean, this is he felt there was no separation and no conflict between his science and his religion. I think we might find that surprising. But Dr. White really felt that all of his scientific endeavors were God-directed, and that his faith and his science were part and parcel of the same drive.
Now, the idea that, this seemed to be one of his central ideas, was that your soul is in your brain. Did he have any scientific or philosophical basis for that view?
He did, and it's somewhat complex because on one hand, when he was speaking to other scientists, he would say, okay, even if you don't believe in the soul, most of us think that the operating principle, right, the personality, the animating spirit, let's say, is in the brain, and that's how we kind of understand it. And from a Catholic perspective, he also believed that the brain equaled the soul. He felt that the brain was the repository of the soul. And he had a very complicated idea that he called the White Principle, Mr. Humble indeed, right, of the White Principle, where he believed that the soul existed in a kind of fourth dimensional space and that it intersected with the brain. So therefore, if you had half a brain, if you had to have half of your brain removed, say, hemispherectomy, you wouldn't therefore have half a soul. So he really believed it was almost like the housing or the point at which the soul touched humanity was at the brain.
Okay, it was kind of like a portal to your spirit then, the brain.
Right, right. Mm-hmm.
In having an aim to try and somehow cheat death by moving a brain from body to body, isn't that kind of messing with God's plan? Isn't that sort of a bit not what a Catholic should be about?
You know, I have to just give you a couple of anecdotes about Dr. White, which I think are illustrative of how he thought about this. Some of his question was due to the fact that we were trying to figure out what was brain death, right? If we're in this era, this is the dawn of organ transplant, and you want to take organs out of bodies, you need to make sure that person is no longer in there. So even if the heart's still beating, you want to make sure that they're brain dead. His question was not, when is the brain dead? But what is brain life? So he wanted to find out, how does the brain live? What is the epitome of brain life? And brain death should equal real death. So he goes to the Vatican to put this question to the Pope, as you do, if you're Dr. White. And he says to the Pope, right, look, I've laid it out for you. I've explained all of the technology and the medical things behind it. can you simply just say and admit that brain death equals real death? And the Pope said, according to White, you know, that's not really my, that's your job, not my job. That's the job of doctors. To which Dr. White really kind of felt like he had just been given permission by the Pope to find the answers to those questions himself. So in many ways, again, when I say he felt that his mission was God-directed, he really meant that. He felt like, okay, it's my job to figure out where these lines are, and I'm going to try and find out. I'm gonna do the science that helps us understand where that ephemeral, muddy point between life and death really is.
Am I correct in saying that actual question still hasn't been entirely sorted out yet?
No, it's true. We have legal definitions of death, and I think most of your listeners are probably familiar with the concept of brain death, and they're familiar with the concept of organ transplant. But imagine that when the first heart was transplanted by Christian Barnard in South Africa, there was not a single agreed upon criteria saying, yes, this brain is dead. You're dead enough for us to take your heart. So they had to establish committees suddenly scrambling, going, oh dear, we're taking hearts out. We should figure this out. And they managed to come up with enough of the criteria that it stood up in court. So there were legal cases around brain death, and we have legal definitions. We don't actually have a specific, universally agreed upon medical definition of death. It's so much so that if the criteria differs, you can actually be declared alive in one country and dead in another.
Huh. Right. So anyway, Robert White gets the green light, as far as he sees it, from the Pope. So his initial experiments, is it on mice and rodents and that kind of thing?
It starts off, yeah. So there's two reasons for doing what he calls the brain isolation experiment. And of course, we can imagine a brain in space. Most of us, it's kind of cartoonish, right? But if you want that brain to be alive when you get it out, that's a much messier process. So he begins experimenting on mice, then dogs, then ultimately on macaque monkeys to see if you can abstract a brain out of its housing, out of the skull, out of the body, while still feeding it with nutrients and blood from a donor monkey or a donor animal, and have that brain completely without body, but still be alive and still be thinking. And that was actually his first big fringy kind of pushing the boundaries experiment, was proof that the brain could live beyond the body.
And you do describe a scene, a rather macabre scene, involving a dog, a priest, and a sandwich.
Yes. So, you know, after all of his work to try and convince everyone that brain death was real death, and again, this there's reasons, right? We want to do organ transplants. We want to save people's lives. We need to make sure that the world understands what brain death is. One day, he invited a priest to his lab, and the priest arrives, and White is sitting there, and on the operating table is presumably a dead dog. A dog is just laying there, and all of its blood has been taken out, and it's in a storage unit container thing in the laboratory. And Dr. White has spread a picnic blanket and has invited the priest to lunch, and there's literally in the same lab on the same table with the dead dog. The priest is horrified, and he won't even come near it. He's just sort of backed up against the wall. White is eating a sandwich. White, who's sort of slightly heavy, bald, big black-rimmed glasses, always carries a pipe, is telling me, oh, you know, is this dog dead? Do you think this dog is dead? And the priest says, why, are you sure? I guess. I don't know. Well, come examine it. Why don't you do last rites on this dog? And the priest is horrified and doesn't want to be there. He says, okay, yes, Dr. White, the dog is dead. And White said, are you sure? Oh, yes. All right. So White whips away the picnic blanket, and he puts all the blood back into the dog, which he has super cooled. Then he brings the dog's temperature back up, and the dog wakes up and walks around the room. And Dr. White looks at the priest and says, either brain death is real death, or I'm like Jesus.
Okay, so. Yeah, Dr. Frankenstein, thank you. The hubris of that.
I know. Well, I should say that the title, Mr. Humble and Dr. Butcher, those are both nicknames that he had. PETA, animal rights groups, called him Dr. Butcher, and he called himself Mr. Humble. So a bit tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah.
But he did do amazing things. I mean, the super cooling process, what he'd learned is that you can take the brain down to an extreme hypothermic temperature, and it stops needing that constant oxygen. Because right now, you know, you and I, we're awake, we're alive. If we get deprived of oxygen, we'll suffer brain damage and then brain death. So what he learned is that you could hypercool a brain, and then you could do all sorts of crazy things like stop blood circulation, and you could technically bring that animal back to life. And it's really important because, of course, open heart surgeries use this today, brain surgeries use this today, and he was even nominated for a Nobel Prize for this perfusion therapeutic hypothermia.
At the time he was nominated for the Nobel Prize, did the people who did the nominating say, like, just don't mention the whole brain transplant stuff?
They did, yes, because of course times change, right? In the 50s and 60s when he's first working, we're not that far out of the war period. The Cold War is going on. There's a fight. There's sort of a race against the Soviet Union, a space race, but also an inner space race, a transplant race against the Soviet Union. And there's a lot more interest in doing things to make sure you're beating the Russians, right? Mm. There's this ideological kind of conflict. And if their science wins, then they win. We can't let their science win. And the Russians had released from the Soviet Union out of Moscow, they had released a video of a two-headed dog where a scientist, a physiologist named Vladimir Demikov had transplanted the head of one dog onto the living body of another dog. And then they're both there. They're both like drinking milk and they're alert. And when this footage came out, it really spooked the West. And so again, when White first starts operating, people are like, yes, we need to figure out how two-headed dogs are made. This is a great idea.
Of course it is.
Right, of course. Well, we're still in the time period where we're worried that maybe the Soviets have figured out telekinesis. I mean, this is, we're not sure what's capable, what people are capable of. And it's the Iron Curtain is shut pretty tightly. So we're not sure what's going on. So at that time, people are like, yeah, okay, this seems like a thing that you should spend your time on. So he does the brain isolation experiment. He proves that the brain, still hooked up to the EEG, has the peaks and valleys. Like, it's still thinking, even though it doesn't have a body. And not everyone believes. A lot of people are still like, I don't know, man. I don't know that monkey's still in there. And that's what spurs him on to do the head transplants.
Yeah.
Head transplant experiments.
And because the Soviets had a two-headed dog already, did that kind of throw some funding his way?
A little bit. I mean, again, it was important not to let them win. I mean, White described it in a letter that he wrote once where he said, you know, we literally were afraid that the Soviets had figured out how to beat death. We thought, oh my gosh, what have they learned to do with heads? What if they could keep the brain of Stalin alive? What if they, you know, I mean, what if they made immortal soldiers? This was a real fear that people had. And so because of that, funding was a little easier to get to, I think, because it's just people wanted to make sure that we were staying on top of things. But the other reason is that isolated organs are useful in their own right. An isolated kidney, if you can study it without the body's interference, you can tell a lot about how it metabolizes and all other sorts of things. So it's not, there are other reasons to have a brain in isolation, looking at the way it interacts with drugs outside of the interference of a creature's body, right? So it's much more, it's easier to study, right? Otherwise you have to go through the skull to get at it, right? Mm. So there's reasons to do it, but there was lots going on into why that was funded at the time that it was. And when he does perform the first primate head transplant, that is taking monkey A's head and putting it on monkey B's body, and it works, successful, though paralyzed, monkey wakes up after the surgery. That at the time was celebrated, but 20 years later, people don't feel the same about that. We've had the civil rights movement. We've had the animal rights movement. All of these things have happened in between those things. And suddenly, you know, it's 25, 30 years later, people are going, why would you want to transplant a monkey's head? You know,
yeah.
And, you know, like maybe that's not. So it's true. When he was nominated for the Nobel Prize, Joseph Murray, who was the first person to do a successful kidney transplant, nominated him. Was like, just don't mention the monkey. Like, let's not talk about that.
And it would be difficult to understate how gruesome those experiments were. In that, like when he was doing the head transplants, yeah. These animals were they conscious when he was doing it?
They were not conscious, but they were alive, so they were anesthetized. And the head transplant, it's interesting. He calls it a head transplant when it's monkeys. He later wants to perform the surgery on human beings, and then he calls it a body transplant. And he tries sort of a rhetorical move, right? It's just like any other organ transplant. You're just getting all the organs at once. But you're absolutely right. It's a very complicated, your head's pretty firmly attached. I mean, you know, people say, you know, if my head wasn't attached, but really it is, it's there, it's connected. And to undo that, there's nerves, there's blood vessels, there's vascular, there's all kinds of things that go into that. And your body's feeding more than just blood to your brain. It's blood and oxygen and nutrients and chemicals and signals and hormones and all kinds of things. So yeah, it's a big deal to take that head off in a way that doesn't damage it.
Yeah, and because he's going through the spinal cord, there's no way of animating the body then.
Right. So Dr. White's feeling was that basically the body served simply as a life support system for the head. Okay. So when he's talking about performing this on human beings, he's talking about it as like last resort. He liked to use Stephen Hawking as an example. He says, here's Stephen Hawking, this great brain, who is still alive at the time. He's this great brain and his body is failing. What if we could just give him a new body, a new life support system, just like changing the batteries, right? And he could carry on and maybe we could keep him alive for an indefinitely long time. So Stephen Hawking was not interested in this, by the way, I just want to say. He was not volunteering. Yeah. But that doesn't mean that no one would.
Yeah.
So there were people who were already paralyzed, but whose bodies were failing them. Christopher Reeve, you know, there's others who wanted to live on, and it wasn't that there was anything wrong with their brains, but severe tetraplegic patients, often their organs would shut down after a period of time. And he does end up with a human being who volunteers for the surgery, who's a paralyzed man.
And this is Craig Vetovitz.
Right.
But obviously he didn't go ahead. He didn't get to the point where he could go ahead with the surgery, or did he?
Going ahead.
Excuse me. Yes.
It's an impossible book to not accidentally fall into euphemism. Like I keep telling people, oh, it's so hard to get your mind around. I mean, head around. You need four things if you're going to perform a head transplant, right? One, you need a willing patient. And you'd think that would be the hardest thing to get. But strangely, that's the first thing Dr. White ends up with. You also need a body donor. And this gets to be much more complicated ethically because, today we do have, even though maybe not a universal definition, we have legal definitions of brain death. A person's heart can still be beating on the autonomic system, and they're called beating heart donors. And that body from a brain dead person, maybe they've been in a car accident or a motorcycle accident, could be used as a donor body for the head transplant surgery. But if you think about it, if that person's a donor, then technically they could save a heart patient, a lung patient, a liver patient. They could donate all sorts of other organs to people who might need them. And now you're giving all of that to one person. So it gets to be somewhat complicated about who decides the value of a single life. On the other side of that, the reason Craig Vetovitz was interested at all was because as a tetraplegic patient, he was told he wasn't a good candidate for organ transplant. So someone out there was basically saying your life's not worth as much as an able-bodied person's life. So you have all of these questions about who gets to decide what the value of life is and whose lives, you know, how do you disperse and distribute something like this? So that's very complicated. The other two things you need are money and permission. And those were the two things that actually White ultimately had the hardest time to come by.
Right. He couldn't get permission, presumably, to do that.
Or money. He got permission from the Soviet Union, but no money. The money was in the United States, but no permission.
Oh, right. And actually, when the wall fell and West Berlin wasn't flooded with two-headed dogs, did interest in his work then kind of dwindle away a bit?
I think Dr. White, from his writings, seems to feel that the fall of the Soviet Union was part of why there was less funding available for sort of pushing the boundary science. But I think it was probably more complicated than that. For one thing, not a lot of people are interested in a surgery that, while transplanting, you know, a body full of organs to help keep you alive, doesn't actually solve the paralysis problem. So it's a pretty small number of people who would be able to benefit from a surgery like this in the first place. So you have partly just not a lot of scientific interest in that. There was much more interest in, can we solve paralysis instead? And so a lot of our scientific research has gone in that direction. Can we fix broken spinal cords? Can we jump the spinal cord you know, using technology to wire directly between brain and body, right? Technologically. So there's a lot of the research kind of went that way. It was much less, let's take the head off and put it on another body, and much more focused on how do we fix the body? How do we fix the skin you're in? You know.
Yes. Having said all that, though, because of White's research and possibly other research, is it now technically feasible to do a head transplant?
It has been technically feasible to do a head transplant since 1971. So, yes, we could absolutely transplant a head. Well, not you and I, but given the proper training and equipment, you could absolutely do it. It's expensive. It's risky. But yes, it's possible to be done. The question is really the should, not the can. And this is a problem for science and technology all the time, isn't it? We tend to get to the can before the should, and our ability technologically often outstrips our availability of the consequences. We're not able to see far enough to see what might happen, and so that can and should argument is really important in situations that deal with the outer edges of what science can do.
Brandy, lovely to speak with you today. Thanks very much for doing so. Dr. Brandy Scalecci's book is called Mr. Humble and Dr. Butcher, A Monkey's Head, The Pope's Neuroscientist and the Quest to Transplant the Soul. You are listening to The Moncrief Show on News Talk. We're going to take a break after that. The woman who didn't want to be found.
Moncrief on News Talk.